My name is Marquita James. I'm 24. Today is December 1st, 2010. I'm here in Montgomery, Alabama with Jamal, whom I just met, but I'm looking forward to getting to know a little better.
Good afternoon. My name is Jamal Fisher, and I am 30. And today is December 1st, 2010, and I'm here at Montgomery, Alabama at Alabama State University, having a wonderful discussion with Marquita.
Well, Jamal, I'm so glad that you decided to stop by today for an appointment. You mentioned earlier that you wanted to dedicate this recording to someone. Do you want to say a little more about that?
Yes, I would like to dedicate this oral story to Damian Harrington, who is more like a brother than a cousin, who I unexpectedly lost this past March. But he lives on through his beautiful child, Jaden Monica Harrington. And it is what has spurred me and inspired me to make sure that I'm very cognizant of oral tradition and keeping my legacy alive and leaving something for Jaden and all the future generations of my family.
For Jaden's benefit, could you describe your cousin a little? What was he like?
Sure. Damian was my alter ego. Just like there's Sasha Fierce, there's Damian to Jamal. I'm the book smart academic. Damian was the life smart. And Jay-Z has nothing on Damian. Damian had plenty of swag and represented Brooklyn to the fullest. He was a DJ. His DJ's name was DJ Gumby. But he was also the light of our family, always having quick wit, always business savvy, always hustling, and always meaning to make those deals. And so I've always encouraged him to write a book. Unfortunately, he had lived long enough to be able to do that, but I hope to be able to remember some of the wisdom that he's passed on and to continue to share that with Jaden and the rest of my family.
What's some of that wisdom?
Well, no offense to the Americans in the house, but we had a saying about American women. And so his wife is from Aruba, and so he always encouraged me to travel internationally and not to limit myself to the oceans of America, but go abroad and see some of the other things that are out there. There's just a mindset and sometimes a mentality, a laid-back atmosphere. Those of us from Cali know it very well. So that was one of the things. But just always the biggest mantra that he had was just do you and keep it moving. And so even when the family would get upset or criticize some of the things that decisions that he might have made or say, I don't know why you're doing that. It didn't matter. He didn't get upset and didn't fuss. Just, hey, I'm just going to do me and keep it moving. And so I try to keep it moving and not stay on, the bitterness or the negative things of life for a while, but just for maybe a few seconds.
You said you and Damian grew up together.
We didn't grow up together in the sense of being in the same state or down the street from one another, but we always have been in each other's lives. By me being raised as a single child, Damian, I always looked to my older male siblings as the older brothers that I never had. So Damian lived in New York. I was born and raised in California. So I would see him during the times that I would visit my father in New York. My mother and father were split up. So that's the time that I would bond with him. He's come out to California once, and I always tell this story, and we'll tell it to Jaden too, about the first time he came to L.A. That was when we were in the midst of the battle between the Crips and Bloods, gangs there, and we could not go anywhere that summer because Damian was so afraid that anybody who had even red or blue, not realizing that the California Angels, those are their colors. There's so many reasons why Californians may have a combination of red and blue on. But he was petrified, even though he was older and was this street tough guy from Brooklyn. We could not go anywhere. So I celebrated my birthday that year at Chuck E. Cheese, even though I was well older than most of the people there. But we could not go to Magic Mountain or Disneyland or some of the other places because he was so afraid of having to be in the midst of a gang battle. That was just a contrast, and I remind him of that when he used to think that he was so much tougher than what he was. And remember the time you came to California? He wasn't so tough then.
How old were y'all then?
I want to say that I was probably maybe about 11, and Damian would have been in his teens. So, you know, I was at that point where I had outgrown a lot of things in life, even though I wasn't that old. And definitely going to Chuck E. Cheese was not the highlight of my summer.
Do you remember anything else from that summer, the first summer he came?
Yeah, we fought a lot, just like brothers, because he liked to watch TV, and I wanted to go outside and go to different places. But because we had this self-imposed asylum inside of the comfort of our house, because Damien was afraid of the world in California at that time, that left us a lot of opportunities to just be in the house and get on each other's nerves. Some other things I remember is he is responsible for killing my only bird that I owned in life, Big Bird, who was a beautiful African macaw of beautiful colors, looked like he came off the Kodak commercial. And the last thing I said to Damien before I went to school was, make sure Big Bird has food and water. And when I came home, Big Bird was not flying around in the cage. And I said, Damien, you seen Big Bird? Did he get out the cage? He said, oh, he's in the cage. So I was small enough that I had to climb on a chair in order to look into the cage. And there Big Bird was. He was in the cage. He just wasn't breathing or responding to anything. He had died because the summer heat of California had crept up in, on him, and he did not have water to cool himself. And so these are some of the less lasting memories I have of my wonderful, loving brother-cousin Damien.
Okay. And you, so you've been thinking a lot about what your legacy will be.
I have. And usually it's been the human experience to wait until once you get in your golden years, as they say, to think about what you want to leave behind to the next generation. But at Damien's untimely death of 33, and I'm not being so far removed from that age myself, I realized that the golden age is the life that you're living right now, and we may not ever get to the period that we normally would reserve for that kind of reflection. So every day that I get up, I am committed to doing something purposeful, meaningful, that if I should be called home at that age, then somebody will remember something. Even on my way over here, I made the time to connect with a previous coworker that I supervised, just to remind her about her legacy, as she's complaining about the working at as a retail clerk at a department store, realizing, you know, how blessed she is even in that experience, as 1.3 point plus million people looking for work, and reminding her that even that job sucks, even though that job sucks, there's a lot of other worse jobs that she could be doing that will expose her to a lot different type of environment and life experience than what she has now. So, you know, like Damien said, just keep it moving. Do what you got to do. Keep it moving.
Is it ever a challenge for you to live in the now?
It's a challenge in a sense that a lot of my close friends say that I think too much. And that may be partly because I'm currently without cable or any other distraction. And so I have nothing but the solitude to be able to contemplate life and things and to be a little more intentional about how I live life. So the challenge is at times is that it would seem that it almost could kill the joy of living when you have to think so much about what I call living in three different times at the same breath, which is past, present, and future. Everything that we do is going to be in those same three frames of reference. And so, you know, and thinking about future as I'm living now and thinking about my past and also how this moment will become part of the past, it leads to some deeper discussions and some even deeper revelations that at times that at the age of 30 are frankly scary and seem to be can overwhelm. But it's not a problem that I think is bad to have. Because it does help set up a framework for the actions and the decisions that I make.
So how have your actions changed, I suppose, since you've begun to live this way?
I guess what is really, it's not so much change as it's been refined. I've always been deemed as the person of the old soul from the time that I was born. A lot of things that I didn't do, such as skipping school or joining gangs myself or some of the other nonsense that normally we're allowed to do as children before we have the conversion of growing up and putting childish things away, I didn't do because I've always thought ahead to this point of life that I'm in now, never completely being able to envision where I would end up, but knowing that I had a purpose. And I guess the conversion point for me was I had a crisis at the age of 13 where I decided that, you know, this life is too much to live. And, you know, as we're focusing now nationally on bullying, I was bullied every day. And it just seemed like the world was conspiring against me. This wasn't a world of make-believe in my mind. This was the real knocks and blows to me as I'm walking home, the you know, getting punched in the stomach as you're eating lunch just for the heck of it. It's the taunting in the classroom that the teacher just has no way of controlling. It's the lonely walk down, you know, from the school back to home and having to know that there's a mob of people chasing after you. And sure, I could run, but, you know, how many days will I have to run before eventually I just had to give up? So it was just easier to accept the beatings and accept the ridicule and accept the taunting and the constant harassment. Even, you know, as we are in Montgomery, I've mentioned this before to others, even being removed off a city bus by an African-American bus driver simply for invoking the name of Rosa Parks and refusing to give up my seat in the front to go back in the back where my the mobsters are, the gangsters are, the people who are causing me to have such turmoil in life are sitting. And so having to be bypassed every time that that bus driver was driving that route, having to redirect my whole way home. So I just decided living was too much. If heaven is such a great place, that's where I wanted to go and have the peace of mind and walk down the golden streets and dip my fingers and hands in the healing streams. And what saved me really was my mother and I are a package deal, and I did not want to think about what her future would be without me being there, knowing that she had made so many sacrifices for me to be there and to make it to the point of age 13. And so at that point is when I began to work on my life philosophy to really live purposeful. I knew that something great was going to happen in life, and all I had to do was remain faithful and steadfast. And then I really took God at his word. You know, it went from just saying I was a Christian and having a Bible to, you said you're going to be a refuge, so you need to be a refuge. And that's how I would talk to the Lord. You know, you see what's going on? I need some protection. And so I need you to do what you said you were going to do. And the Lord has not failed me yet. I've made it this far through his grace and his help. And so it's just been a constant refinement. And as I become age 30, I don't see it as going downhill. I don't see it as me being old. I see now that I'm more free and more emancipated to live out my life the way that I had in those earlier stages of my life, age 13, had decided that I wanted to live it. And so I'm living my life fully, completely, unabashed, with legacy firm in my mind. And the legacy will be that I live my life as I wanted to live, not because of preconceived notions or out of fear of what people may think or respond to. I'm just going to live my life, and when it's over, it's over.
So where does that mean you're headed? Does that mean you don't plan?
There means there's planning, but there's always planning to be flexible, too, with the plans. You know, this whole experience of how I arrived to Montgomery, to be the next door neighbor to two or the three surviving civil rights activists of the Montgomery bus boycott, how I arrived to Montgomery after going to a family reunion where you have one freedom fighters that remain, the Honorable Congressman John Lewis speak, how I've arrived to all the places of purpose in my life, has come with some thinking about how I want to get there, but then just completely allow myself to be free to be dictated and guided to those points. And the way that everything has unfolded is in a way that I will never be able to unfold. I will make a mess out of this life, and so I'm just glad that things have happened the way that they have. You know, you plan, but then you also plan to do something differently, too.
So you're new to Montgomery.
I am. I've just been here for maybe about 2 months.
And how is that?
Montgomery is wonderful. I mentioned that I live right next door to Reverend Robert Gretz and Jeannie Gretz, who are two brave, courageous white citizens of Montgomery at that time who stood up and was a part of the Montgomery Improvement Association. And we also lived right across the street from where F. Scott Fitzgerald also lived. And so Montgomery is a lot quieter than Los Angeles or Chicago or New York or some of the other bigger cities that I've been in. But the solitude has been enriching. And so I find myself writing essays and commentaries about my life experience and what's going on here. And so I'm just engaged in the history and the time that I'm in and having a wonderful ride while I'm here.
Is it lonely being in a new city?
It's not lonely unless you don't do anything with all the free opportunity you have now to realize that you're by yourself and to be by yourself. And that's really how I make the distinction between being lonely and being in an enriching solitude. Is that I'm using the time alone to really do things, to, you know, as I said, to pursue my passion of writing, to go out here and create a rich legacy, not waiting to 60, but doing it now. So every Tuesday I've committed myself to tutoring middle school, elementary, high school students in a subject that I absolutely hated in coming up, which is math, but I'm committed to doing that, and part of that experience is not just what we actually go over, the concepts, the algorithms, the theorems, but it's also giving them the encouragement for them to see someone who looks like them, who also struggled with math, and know that you can still be successful. It's getting them to speak up and be confident. My students will tell you that I always tell them you're either going to be confidently wrong or you're going to be confidently right, but you will be confident. We will not say, I think the answer is, oh, I don't know, it may be. No, you will speak with confidence. And so that's also boosting their self-confidence in not only the subject, but also in how they live their life. And so that's another way that I'm trying to prepare them for the future, as I'm also leaving hopefully a valuable gift with them in the one-on-one sessions that we have. So I'm, you know, just really, again, using my time wisely, and that's what's enriched my life and made this took me over the point of being lonely to just understand that I'm in a solitude experience right now.
You're talking about enriching solitude. I mean, you have a very robust internal life, and I'm just curious, what's your earliest memory? What's the first thing you can recall?
The first thing that I can recall from life?
From life.
Okay. The first thing I can recall is that my mother used to, and this is how early the memory is, when I was still sleeping in the crib, my mother used to have my crib housed in her bedroom. And I guess always curious, I remember distinctly the night that the crib was moved from the bedroom to the kitchen. And that's because I was curious about all the nocturnal activities that happened in the bedroom. And so when I heard something that disturbed my rest, I stood up on my 2 feet and I put my head through the bars and I was completely engaged in the experience of life. And I guess for some, my mother, that might have made her very uncomfortable. And so when we talk about my memory around dinner tables such as Thanksgiving, I always remind my mother, you don't want me to go back in time and tell you my first earliest memory. And so that is my earliest memory. I remember seeing the activities at night, and then I remember the next morning I was next to the refrigerator, and I couldn't understand, how did I get to the refrigerator? And then always determined not to allow anything to stop me, I then jumped out of the crib and crawled to my mother's bedroom where I'm traditionally used to sleep. So that required my mother then to lower the bed mattress, the crib mattress, so that I wouldn't be able to do that. But I was determined, still the same. So that's my earliest memory.
And how does your mother respond to, so when that comes up at the dinner table, what does she say?
There's always embarrassment and just a shock that I can still remember that 30 years ago. And I don't remember I don't know what the age is of children when they're in cribs, but I imagine that it's pretty much been almost like a 29, 28 year memory. And it's still just as vivid and fresh. I can tell it with such conviction when I tell that story. And I think that embarrasses her as well.
What's your mother like?
What is my mother? My mother is like me.
Your package deal.
My mother is like me. I have a lot of her mannerisms. I have my father's quiet spirit. If you can imagine that, I am quiet. I'm only talkative because this is a recording. But her tenacity and for not being discriminated against or allowing anybody to put any artificial barriers on her, I have a lot of that. I'm very vocal. And my mother has been in part of every major social movement of her time, from, you know, the Black Panthers to the Rastas to just protesting in front of the White House over the administration policies of Nixon. She's been always on the forefront. So she's always been my local civil rights person and has always given me the tools to stand up and speak up for myself. So I always stand tall and I walk with purpose, and it don't matter if I'm the youngest or the shortest person in the room or if I'm in coach. My mother has taught me that I'm a first class, notable person and a person to be respected, and I feel that and I live that.
What's one of your favorite memories of her?
One of my favorite memories of my mother. There's such a wide collection of memories.
It can be any of them.
Trying to think. My mother, because she's a very interesting person. I guess going back, one of my favorite memories is when my mother came to my aid. I mentioned earlier about being bullied. And so as a result of being beaten and having a huge knot develop on the back of my head from walking from school back to home, I guess it really concerned my mother. And so I remember my mother went to confront these wannabe gangsters and at their house. And she was full of fire. And I was almost afraid for her because she threatened all kind of things she was going to do if they ever came in close proximity to me again. Of course, I was in the car embarrassed because I knew what that was going to mean the next day for the next walk. And she had a gun, and she's always reminded me that, you know, even knowing that as a baby I was going to be taller than her, that if she couldn't beat me, then she knew how to shoot. And so she reminded these wannabe gangsters. So if you can imagine, this was like a traditional showdown of the Wild Wild West. Instead of a dusty road and, you know, a saloon on every side and people gathering, was my mother in the middle of a cul-de-sac with three wannabe gangsters. And she told me that she can get gangster too. And she had a gun, so bring it. And I said, and then my mother then got on me, which was kind of unexpected. She was angry with me because I didn't fight back. And so that's when I really realized what a different time we were living in and how truly my mother didn't really understand all the battles that I had endured, the ones that I had never shared with her. Because she came from a time where you can fight back, and that was it. You either got whipped or you would whip somebody, and then you end up being best friends later on down the years, and you traveled the road just like Oprah and Gail. But in the 90s, that wasn't the case. You fight and you prevail. That means somebody will come with more people the next time. And then eventually somebody's going to lose their life. And having made the decision, as I explained to you, of living life, I definitely wasn't going to put myself now in a position to lose it by somebody else's hand. And so that meant that I had to endure beatings. I had to, you know, suck some things up and just continue to live for graduation day or the time when I can get away. And so that opportunity came in 1993 is when I moved to North Carolina to live with my grandmother. And that's a different time frame. We went skipped the 60s to go back to the 30s and the 40s. And so it was just like being on a time machine, just going in reverse rather than to the future.
Can you say more about that? What do you mean?
Well, my grandmother, we talk about old school, but she when she was in the old school, it was just current new school. So that's how old school she is. And so, you know, my grandmother came from an era where children were never heard in the house. Parents would say something and then you would do. I was raised by a liberal mother who encouraged discussion. We made everything by a vote of two. And so, you know, when I tried to bring those politics to my grandmother's house, she shut that down very quickly. And I remember one day, even though my grandmother comes to my mid-chest, she looked up at me and she said, "I'm going to slap your face if you don't go to your room," because I decided I wasn't going to go to the family church, which is a sin in Black families, especially in the Bible Belt South. The church was dead or you were dying. And so I just decided I'm going to go to a church where the people are alive. And she says, "Well, Jesus is everywhere." And I said, "Exactly. That's why I'm going to go and serve him over at this church." And she said, "Go to your room now or I'm going to slap your face." And I didn't want my grandmother to have to pull out a stool, go through the hassle of getting up on the top step to smack my face. So I removed myself from the situation. And then I did what I normally do. In my poetic justice moment, I wrote about it in a poem, because I was free to say things in the poem or in the guise of a poem that I would never be able to have the liberation to say to her directly. And so it was that kind of new school, old school battle. And one of the things my grandmother said, that was my welcoming statement to North Carolina, was that if you're not careful, you're going to get lynched. And my retort to it was that they still do that. And so I had lots to learn about the politics and the subtleties of being in the South, coming from Los Angeles, which is, and California, which is a country of its own. So that was how the relationship began to build. But I learned a lot from my grandmother, and she's still with us today. And I think I taught her some things, too.
What did you learn from her?
Well, I learned that there was more than one way to fight a battle. And maybe being so vocal and so abrasive and so in someone's face may not be the way. And I learned about how she fought the battles. I'm obviously going through the segregation of the racial segregation of being in the South already. She grew up in North Carolina, moving to New York and then, you know, being part of the Reconstruction. So even though she was not a slave, having to work and labor just as hard for a white Jewish family, there is a lot of parallels to that experience and how she kept her dignity to raise 8 children as a single parent living in New York. So the battles that she fought and how she got her way wasn't always upfront and direct. Sometimes it was very subtle. Sometimes it was just a matter of being patient and waiting for the right opportunity to be able to make a impact and make sure that people understood that she meant business. She never has been a lady to fuss and scream and yell, but she was always respected. So I try to take on some of those qualities too, but I reserve the angry Black card at any time when it's deemed necessary. And I embrace that. I don't run away from that label.
Why not?
Because I think at times that's the only way that people are aware of whatever they're doing, which is inconsiderate or indecent. I know that there's been a lot of criticism of our current president, Barack Obama, for his lack of showing these qualities. And then he was criticized again when he did allow that side of him to slip out. And that's in reference to the Gulf oil disaster, when he said he was looking for somebody's, and you can fill in the blank, to kick, as he was thinking every morning about that experience. And so sometimes I think it's good to be able to realize that even in this technical dominated world where we emote through icons and LOLs to tell you that I'm laughing, sometimes we need to evoke a real human emotion that people can connect with that won't be misconstrued. And when anger is one of those, you know angry when you see angry. There's no ever any doubts about someone who's angry and dissatisfied.
Jamal, can you tell me about a time you had to break out your angry Black man card?
Yeah, you said a time, which is very generous, because there's many times where not so much now as I've come into this age of being a little wiser, a little mature. But one of the times I can tell you from being a kid in California, I was eating in a famous restaurant known for its symbol of golden arches. And I was very independent as a kid, so I was riding my bike, and I had rode my bike to McDonald's. Oh, I slipped and said the name. I apologize. And I parked my bike on the side of the wall, trying to put it out of the way of on the walkway. But of course, McDonald's is a drive-through place. They don't think about the bicycle customers. So there was no place to lock up a bike. And I guess either the wind or people walking by, somehow the bike fell down and started to block and obstruct the path then. And I'm sitting there enjoying whatever the Mac Mill was of that moment. And the manager just loudly starts screaming and ranting, "Whose bike is this? Whose bike is this? Somebody needs to move this bike. I don't know why." And just yelling and screaming. And so I went out and I first corrected the situation, which was to put the bike upright and to move it out the way. But then I took the additional initiative to go up to the manager and I called her over to the table. Now, you have to imagine somebody who's 13 talking to someone who's well senior. And I said, "What is your name?" And she said, "My name's this." I said, "You're the manager?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I just wanted to give you some feedback about that experience." I said, "Now, you look around this restaurant and you can probably, using your best educated guess, who's probably came here on a bike. Surely it wasn't those old people sitting over there. They're together, so that would have meant they would have had two bikes." And so I just broke it down through that. So all of that ranting and raving you did was embarrassing. I said, "You just could have simply used your best guess and come over to the table and said, 'Young man, is that your bike?' And then show me where I can leave the bike. Obviously, you have not designed a restaurant for biking customers." And so I'm very unsatisfied with that experience. And so I can tell that she had never thought about that and really could see in my passion that I spoke in that I was really convicted by this experience. And so what it led to was not only a comp meal for the meal that I was eating, but a coupon book for future meals. And she apologized to me. She really realized that she had overstepped and really, and trying to be a leader of that franchise, she had failed to lead in other ways. And so that's one of my mild moments. Some of the other moments, just to protect those who are still living and innocent, I won't explain. But people are very well known. My anger is well known. And I only use it when we get to that purpose. I always try to work through the channels that of politeness and subtlety that we put in place, which we call rules and laws and protocol and social norms. But after you exhaust all those, then you just got to bring out the angry card and whip it on the table like you're playing a game of spades. And you never lose that way.
How do you think your family would describe your personality?
My family is confused by me, I believe. They only now get to see the different layers of what the world knows about me. And I guess I like that because it keeps them, they never can really truly define me. I think in my legacy, as we're talking about legacy, that when I do transition, that the stories that people will tell about their experience with me will really surprise them. But my family's come to see, understand that I do have a wonderful sense of humor. I love to tell stories, which is why I'm part of this experience, because I love hearing stories. And there's so many different parts of me, beyond just being the librarian or the quiet one or the smart one or the one who's academic. And I guess as we grow together as a family, I'll feel, it's not that I fear them seeing that. I guess I like being able to play a different role when I'm with my family than what I normally reserve for how I deal and interact with the world.
How is it different?
Well, definitely I have to be a little more bombastic than I am when I'm at home. I like quiet and solitude at times. And so I don't tend to do a lot of fussing and a lot of correction and a lot of just talking about a lot of things, unless we're in some kind of discussion about passions, politics, education, state of Black people today, you know, injustice that even families can and have on one another. That's when you will see the more lively discussions come out of me. But for the most part, I like to observe and just really enjoy seeing my family as they're interacting with one another, because those are the snapshots that I keep with me as I'm living by myself in Montgomery and need to have family gather around. I go back to those moments, I download them, and then I remember those experiences.
Jamal, I wonder if there are any stories from your family's history that you find personally inspiring or uplifting or telling?
I guess the one that I can quickly think of would be just as what I mentioned about my grandmother, being a single mother and raising 8 stair-step kids and not living in a mansion but in a project apartment, which didn't have many rooms. And two, I think is my best memory for all the boys and girls that she had. And somehow being able to still survive through that experience, to be able to provide such a backbone that many of them are successful today. And comparing that to how people struggle with much more access to support and networks with fewer children. But somehow she made it work. And she did such a wonderful job that the legacy that I inherited was that I am successful as one of her grandchildren, and many of the grandchildren are successful too. This is a lady who did complete high school, but you know, not any formal education, never, you know, a college degree. Her degrees were earned in different ways and in different areas. Economics, she can tell you all about how to stretch a dollar to feed 8 children with one income. And so sometimes I think that maybe they should just hire some grandmothers to figure out the debt problems that we're currently facing as a nation.
What's your grandmother's name?
My grandmother's name is Dorita McNeil Harrington. And she, as I stated, resides. She will be, I believe, 85 or 86 in this coming year. And she was actually born on September 11th. We celebrate that day in different contexts every year. And actually, the time that September 11 happened was the only day that I can remember that I didn't call my grandmother early in the morning. And the reason was being fascinated by catching up with all the latest information that was coming out of New York and Pennsylvania and other places on that time, on that morning. And so as you have a tragedy, then you also have the affirmation that life is still going on. And so she's one of the first calls that I make on September 11th just to, you know, wish her happy birthday and let her know that I'm thankful and grateful that she's still here with us.
And then we have just a couple minutes left. I'm curious about, you said there you think you taught your grandmother some lessons during the time you lived there. I'm curious about what you think those are, but if there's something else you'd like to spend these last few minutes on, that's fine, too.
Okay. Well, I think I definitely revived my grandmother in a sense. As you get older, you get a little more dust settled on you. You get a little in age, and you get a little distant from the current times. But I, being a young person and being part of the current times, I think I introduced some of those things to her. So my grandmother has a cell phone now, and she's and she knows what Facebook is, and she knows a little bit about the technology. And every once in a while, you'll hear her, especially with my my younger uncles, use some of the more up-to-date language. You know, what's up? What's up? So, you know, those kind of things. I think she also came to learn how to respect my views as well. You know, I mentioned that she was one about just being seen and not heard, but I think she really opened up herself to actually hear and knew that it was important not to just talk all the time and not to just be listened to all the time, but to also hear, you know, what the concerns are. And I think it really enriched her ability to love and connect with a lot of my cousins, too. And so those are the things that I think she's learned from me. And that it's okay to be a little courageous. You don't always have to be so safe. Take some risk.
Well, thank you so much, Jamal, for leaving this record, you know, for Dayton and for whomever else comes along in the future.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.